How do I deal with the bondages in my life? The things for which I desperately desire to be delivered. That is the question. In Matthew chapter 17, the scripture that was read in your hearing that we have heard previously, we have a story. And oh, what a story it is. To appreciate where I'm going, the first thing I want you to understand is the concept involved of a mountain. Verse 20 says that if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, be moved. And it will move. The concept of a mountain means a difficulty you can't climb over. He's not talking about a literal mountain here. He's talking about a mountain symbolically. That is, a situation in your life where you are stuck. This thing is too steep for you to climb, even though you've tried. It's too big a hump for you to get over. It's your mountain. Now, there are a lot of different mountains with a lot of different sizes, but all of them boil down to the same thing, and that is a difficulty or problem in life that cannot be solved through ordinary means. And the way you know it can't be solved is you've tried, and that mountain has not moved. You find yourself a helpless victim of habitual behavior, attitudes, or circumstances that enslave you or controls you. That's a mountain. You can't shake it off. You mean well. You promise not to do it again. You make a determination, and wouldn't you know it, the mountain just keeps getting in your way. A mountain is not a momentary lapse. Mountains don't move. It's stuck there on the same piece of property in your life that it's always been. Because it's a mountain, not a momentary problem that happened once and will never happen again. You've used willpower, the power of positive thinking. You prayed about it. You sought counseling concerning it. And the mountain won't move. Are there any mountains in the house this morning? The reason he uses the word mountain is because of the context in which this story is found. Jesus has just taken Peter, James, and John to the Mount of Transfiguration. They just came down from a literal mountain, see? So because they had just come down from a literal mountain, Jesus uses the figurative concept of mountain because that's what's on their minds right now. In fact, on this mountain, chapter 17, verse 1, a high mountain, it's called, he was, verse 2, transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His garments became as white as light. Jesus Christ was transfigured, that is, there was the zipping down of his humanity, the zipping down of his humanity, and the revealing of his deity. The fact that he was God showed forth. The Father said, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Elijah and Moses showed up from the Old Testament. Peter, James, and John are there from the New Testament. So you got the whole Word of God represented at the Son of God being supervised by the Father at this glorious mountain meeting. When they descended the mountain and came down, they discovered there were other mountains. You know what that's like, to come to a worship service on Sunday morning and have a mountaintop experience, only to leave church and hit the valley of despair because you run into mountains you can't handle. You know what that's like to praise God in the sanctuary and cuss people in the parking lot. Whatever your mountain is fundamentally controlled by your mind. And so he says, what Satan does is he builds mountains or fortresses or strongholds by blocking off the access to divine power. Just so you don't feel too bad, let me show you an illustration of a Christian, the greatest Christian that ever lived, who had such a stronghold. Romans 7. Paul the Apostle had a point in his life where he struggled with a mountain. He does not say what the mountain was, but he does describe the struggle. He says in verse 18 of Romans 7, "For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh, for the wishing is present in me, but the doing of the good is not." Do I have a witness? He says, it's not that I don't want to do right. He says, for some reason, I don't seem to be able to. He goes on and he says, for the good that I wish, my motives are good, I do not do. In fact, I practice the very thing that I do not wish. Is there anybody here who does things they don't want to do, use words they don't want to use? Well, the good news, the bad news is that's a mountain. The good news is Paul's a witness. He's been there. Verse 23, I have two different things working in me. I have a different law in the members of my body waging war against the law of my mind. I got this conflict. That's a mountain. A mountain is being locked in to a situation that you don't want to be in. Now, if you're locked in it because you want to be in it, that's rebellion. But I'm talking about a situation you know is wrong, don't want to be a part of it, but don't seem to be able to shake it or be delivered from it. That's a mountain. That's a stronghold, and it is to you I speak today. That was the situation in Matthew 17. We have a young man here who has been brought to the Lord, verse 15. Mark tells us he couldn't speak. Mark tells us he couldn't hear. Mark tells us that he would foam at the mouth. He would go into convulsions. He would have epileptic fits. And let me tell you, proof positive when you know you got a mountain. You've got a mountain, one, when you want to get rid of it but can't. Verse 16. And I brought him to your disciples and they could not cure him. Even folk can't help you. It's a mountain when you go to the folk who's supposed to be able to help you and they can't help you. The folk who had all God all over them couldn't help me either. That's a mountain. A mountain is when you've tried everything you've had. You've gone to every 12-step program in the city, tried the psychic line, you read the horoscope, you've called on the pastoral staff, you've tried the righteous and the unrighteous, and nothing works. That's a mountain. Secondly, the confusion about mountains. Part of the problem was that they were looking at the external activity of the boy to determine the diagnosis of the problem. Watch it. Anybody throwing himself in the fire, they had fires all over Israel out in the open, and he'd just see a fire and go dive into it. He'd find a puddle of water and jump into it. Anytime you do that, you're going to have scars. If you jump in the fire, you're going to have burns on your body. So he's been scarred up from his mountain. Anybody got any scars from your mountain? Scars, because you've been cut up by the situations you are in. And as far as everybody else was concerned, when they saw that boy coming, they would have simply registered him as crazy. But from the text, we discover that the things he was doing on the outside was because of a spiritual problem he had on the inside. This boy was demon-possessed. Jesus, in a moment, is going to have to cast out the demon. We'll see that in a moment. He's going to have to, verse 18, rebuke him, and the demon is going to come out. Now watch this. His external activity was due to a internal problem. And my point about your mountain is simply this. If we're going to move the visible mountain of your fruit, we're going to have to get down to the invisible mountain of your root. Many of us have been trying to chop down mountains that are seen without addressing underground what is not seen. And if you try to fix a big mountain that you see and don't know that underneath the ground is the foundation of that mountain, then what you're doing is messing with the fruit when your problem's at the root. They were confused about the diagnosis. The disciples were confused. Verse 19. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" So they're confused. The father is confused because he doesn't really understand what the real problem is. The son is confused because he's in the problem and can't, you know, doesn't know what's going on because he's not always acting all there. The disciples were confused because they were the ones who've been ordained by God to be able to cast out demons and they can't get rid of the problem. You find out in Mark chapter 9, the people are confused because they thought the disciples should have been able to cast out the problem. So everybody's confused about the mountain. And mountains can get quite confusing. Why does this thing have me like it does? Now, let me correct something here. First of all, I want you to know that you can have physical problems. And if you have a physical problem, then you need a doctor. Nothing wrong with that. But in this story, this mountain was due to a spiritual root that had to be addressed. The disciples were embarrassed. They saying, "Come out, nothing happening. Change, nothing's happening." And that helped me to find out the disciples couldn't do it, because that let me know I'm not supposed to be able to fix everything. And you'll see why in a moment. So that leads us to, there was confusion about what the diagnosis really was. You know, many times you can have things wrong on the outside because there's something that needs fixing on the inside. And if you have a mountain as we've defined it, you must diagnose the spiritual cause if you're going to fix its external expression. If you have an addiction, that is the symptom, not the problem. You don't have a sex addiction problem. You have a sex addiction fruit that is indicative of a spiritually demented root. If you have a drug problem, you have a drug problem symptom, not a drug problem essence. If you can't put down a cigarette, that's a symptom. What we got to do is get beneath the ground to find out what Satan is stirring up on the inside that's producing the inability, the partition that keeps God from getting through to turning things around on the outside. And when I studied this, I said, that's it. People are spending their lives to fix the outside, not having diagnosed properly the inside, so they don't fix the inside, so they struggle forever with the outside. That leads to a third point. The confidence regarding mountains. Look at what Jesus says in verse 17. "Oh, unbelieving and perverted generation." That's not what you'd call a compliment. "How long will I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me." Or to put it in ordinary English, I'm tired of you folks. How do you think Christ feels about us when he sees our powerlessness due to lack of faith? Verse 20, "Because of the littleness of your faith, for truly I say to you, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you." Now that's deep. He says, if you have enough faith, you'll talk to the difficulty in your life, mountain, and the mountain will move. Did you just hear that? Now, I didn't make that up. That's what verse 20 says. He says, if you didn't have little faith, then you would be able to say to this mountain, "Get out of here." Say to this addiction, "Go away." Say to this inability to control my tongue, "Shut up." Say to this mind I can't control, "Think straight." And the mountain, the difficulty, will submit. Now that just seems a little bit too good to be true, that I can just tell it what to do and it'll do it. He says the problem is related to little faith. Now it raises the question, what is little faith? How do I know if I have little faith versus great faith? I have people tell me all the time, I have faith in God, but nothing's working. Well, maybe you have little faith. How do I know if it's little or if it's great? Well, let me tell you the difference between little faith and great faith. When you have little faith, the lie of Satan is more believable than the truth of God. You see, great faith sets no limit on what God can do. And I'll illustrate that in a moment. Here's little faith. Little faith is the kind of faith you have when you've put enough other things in place so that if God doesn't come through, you're going to be okay anyway. That's little faith. Little faith means, God, I need you and I trust you, but if you mess up, I just want you to know I'm still covered. I have gotten enough other things situated that if you don't supply it, I'm still going to be okay. So I'm going to trust you, but I don't really need you. But it's nice to have you. You know what great faith is? Great faith is when you are trusting God and the very opposite to what you are trusting him occurs. And you still trust him. Great faith was like the disciples on the water. Jesus said, let us go to the other side, but it rained and the boat was sinking. Great faith lays down on a cushion when the boat is sinking because it believes that when God said, let us go to the other side, you still gonna get to the other side. Great faith is faith that operates when the opposite to what you are trusting God for occurs. That's great faith. Now, he then tells us something that has led to a lot of confusion, perhaps even in this room. If you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall be able to say to this mountain, get out of here. Say to this drugs, leave me alone, and the mountain will move. Now, that's what the Bible says. And either you're going to believe the Bible or you're going to believe your experience, your circumstance, your feelings, or your situation. Question is, what you're going to believe? You say, well, wait a minute. I have mustard seed faith. A mustard seed is only a tiny little seed. It is. It is the smallest seed of garden plants. There is no smaller seed in Jesus' day than the size of a mustard seed. So you say, well, wait a minute. And even Jesus says they had little faith because he says, because of your little faith. A mustard seed is a little seed. So we have a contradiction here. Jesus says you have little faith and condemns them, but then tells them if you have mustard seed faith, that's all the faith you need for the mountain to move, and a mustard seed is a little seed. So we got a contradiction. He condemns them because they have little faith and then tells them but all they need is little faith in order to move a mountain. You follow me? We don't have a contradiction. What we have is a misunderstanding of mustard seed. Turn to chapter 13, hold your finger here, verse 31. And he presented another parable to them saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. When a man took and sowed in his field, and this is the smaller than all the other seeds, but when it is full grown, it is larger than the garden plants. Becomes a tree so that the birds of the air can come and nest in its branches. Now watch it. A mustard seed is very, very tiny. But that's not Jesus' point. Here's Jesus' point. When you take a teensy weensy eensy bit mustard seed, plant that bad boy in the right soil, its external shell splits. Inside the mustard seed are little tiny miniature seeds that's even smaller than the mustard seed. But guess what happens underneath the ground? When the external breaks and opens up, the internal expresses itself. And what was held hostage on the inside by the hard shell on the outside is now free to express itself. And when this little itsy bitsy teeny weeny mustard seed sheds its external shell and begins to do its internal thing, that know-nothing seed becomes a 15-foot plant bigger than all the other plants in the garden, although it started as the smallest seed in the garden. And not only does it get bigger than all the other plants in the garden, other birds can come and sit down and rest on it because it's so strong now. He does not mean that you have to have tiny faith. He says if you take the tiny faith you have and plant it right, stripping it of its external shell, what has been held hostage on the inside will begin to express itself on the outside, and you're going to find out not only can you grow and not only are you a 15-foot Christian, but other folk can rest on your life too. That's how strong you are. So guess what? That mountain in your life, that mountain in your life is because the shell on the outside is controlling the life on the inside. So what you got to do is split the shell so that the life on the inside can express itself. But no mustard seed ever grew without being buried first. He means if you have the faith of a mustard seed that is willing to die, be buried, be stripped of its external so that it can express its internal, then you can say, mountain, get out of here. You get a little acorn that drops in the middle of a pavement where the pavement is split. If that thing drops into the middle of a pavement and is able to sink in and express itself, and that external shell cracks, and what's on the inside begins to express itself, the pavement will move. I'm talking cement will begin to spread out. Why? Because there's power compacted in the shell. And a lot of us here are power gone unnoticed. Power gone unnoticed. We haven't expressed the internal because it's been held in check by the shell. But if you have faith of a mustard seed, he says, you shall say to this mountain, be moved. Turn with me to Mark 9, where Mark tells the same story, but he gives us a little bit more information. Jesus says, in verse 18, they said, the father says, I told your disciples they couldn't do anything. Verse 19, Jesus says, oh, unbelieving generation, how long will I put up with your lack of faith, basically? Verse 20, they bring the boy to him. Immediately, the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling about and foaming at the mouth. Okay? So he's in a chaotic situation here. And he asked the father, how long has this been happening? He said, long time. This mountain been here a long time, from a childhood. And it has often thrown him both in the fire, in the water to destroy him. Now watch this now. Watch it now. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. Now that doesn't sound too bad, does it? Come on, Jesus. If you can help me, help me. What is Jesus' response? Jesus said, if you can. Who are you talking to, boy? If you can. Do you know who you're talking to? If you can. And I know that's the sentiment because he says, all things are possible to him who believes. What do you mean, if you can? Look at what the man does in verse 24. Immediately. He didn't think about it. Because if he thought about it, he wouldn't know what to do. So he stopped thinking and started trusting. Immediately, the boy's father cried out and began saying, I do believe, help my unbelief. That's a different statement. Hey, verse 24 is different than verse 22. In verse 22, he said, if you can. In verse 24, he says, I choose to believe. Your choice to trust God or not to trust God is a choice. It's got nothing to do with how you feel. This has to do with deciding whether he's worthy to be trusted. He says in verse 22, he says, but if you can do anything, take pity on us. I use the word if. I'm going to change my word. You can. Take out if. You can. But I'm going to tell you the truth. I still have my doubts. But notice what he did. He changed the order. In verse 22, he raised the doubt about Jesus. In verse 24, he raised the doubt about himself. In verse 22, he questioned God. In verse 24, he questioned him. And if you want to question anybody, question you. Don't say, God, why won't you deliver me? That's questioning God. What you ought to say is, God, why won't I choose to trust you to deliver me? Now you're questioning you. He says, Lord, I choose to believe. By an act of my will, you can do it. But please help my unbelief. Now notice something. When he changed the order, God gave him the miracle. When he changed the order, God gave him the cure. Because he changed his perspective, God moved. To enjoy spiritual power and spiritual victory, you need spiritual resources, not human prescription. This isn't the time to be sadiddy. This isn't the time to be sophisticated. When you have a mountain, you don't have to be cute. When you have a mountain, you bring the mountain to Jesus. He said, here's my mountain. I got a son. He's crazy. Your disciples can't fix it. I can't fix it. Doctors can't fix it. And it needed to be fixed, and you can fix it. And even when I said you can fix it, I have some doubt in my heart, but you're so big, you not only can fix my son, you can fix my doubt. You're so big, you can not only fix my mountain, you can fix my question about your ability to fix my mountain. So I'm not only trusting you to fix my son, I'm trusting you to fix my doubt about your ability to fix my son, so I'm coming to you about father and son. I am laying myself on you. And he says, when you do that, you'll be able to say to the mountain, oh, watch this now. You'll be able to speak to the mountain. What's the mountain? The problem. And the mountain will go away. Now, you know our problem? The mountain is talking to us. See, we're getting this wrong. Who talking to who? The difficulty is saying, you can't stop this. The difficulty is saying, you can't stop using that language. You've been using that language all your life. You can't stop taking that drug. You've been taking these drugs all for 10 years now. How are you going to stop? You can't stop doing this. How are you going to stop? The mountain does all the talking. But he says, if you get me in right perspective, we can switch the conversation. And when the mountain says you can't stop, you can look back at the mountain and say, man, you're a fool. You done lost your ever-loving mountain mind. Because you don't tell me what to do anymore. I tell you what to do. And right now, you want to cuss. But since I'm running the show, let me say to your cussing tongue, shut up. You're not even going to talk right now. I'm taking over the conversation. You can tell the drug desire of your body, you are telling me that I have got to take some crack cocaine. I got to put a needle up in my arm. But let me tell you something, because the mountain will no longer talk to me. I'm talking to the mountain. You're not getting nothing. You're not going to pop no pill. You're not going to shoot no junk in your arm. And the reason you're not going to do it is because I'm running this show from the inside out. You're not running it from the outside in. You take over the conversation. I think the text says you will be able to say to the mountain, the difficulty, you will set the rules. It's a new ball game. And we've been trying and we've been trying and we've been trying. Why try to push a bus out of a ditch when Clark Kent's in it? If Clark Kent's on the bus, you talk to Clark. Say, change clothes. You don't go be stretching and straining. We've been, it just hit me. We stretch and strain and I'm trying. And then we as counselors sometimes fail because we say, try more. We've been trying. And it's not that you don't have responsibility. It's that somebody else is on the bus. You say, well, wait a minute. Now. I am not where you're talking. I want to be there, but I'm not there yet. How do I get from where I am to where you're talking right now that this stuff that's been plaguing me for all these years, I can begin to have victory over? Well, let me close with Matthew 17. And by the way, I want you to notice something. It's back in Mark 9. I'll summarize it for you. When Jesus told the demon come out, the demon resisted. The demon tried to link, hold on tighter to the boy. Now, if the demon resisted Jesus, when Jesus said, be gone, you think he's going to just jump out because you're talking? Okay. So I'm going to tell you now. When you start taking this approach of faith, the demon will hold on tighter because he's been used to running the show. And you know how it is, husbands, when we come back home and we neglected being the right kind of husband, and then we come home and talk about we're going to lead again? And our wives say, where? You know, I've been taking care of this house for all these years. You just can't come back in here talking about you're going to be the leader. Anybody married anybody like that? You better put your hand down. Right? Because the wife has been used to running it so long. Okay? That's how the devil is. He's been used to running you so long. So once you say, new rules, I'm talking, I am setting the agenda, he's going to hold on tight. But that's your cue that you didn't mess with it. That's your cue. If it gets worse, when you make this decision, you know you're on it. You done got him now. The mere fact it gets worse says you done shook up the boy. Every other time when he held on tight, you quit. This time is another time and all kind of hell is breaking loose in your life. Why? Because he knows this is not like the other times. It's different time. And so he says in verse 21 of chapter 17, for this kind does not come out except by prayer and fasting. That brings us back to our theme. This mountain, this thing that's this difficult, this problem that's been in your life this long, this problem or sin that Satan has had control of this long, doesn't come out by going to church on Sunday. Doesn't come out just because the pastor or the pastoral staff or the counseling center all have their place. But it doesn't come out just because you talk to them, because the disciples can't handle this one. It's too deep. It's been there too long. Satan has too much of a stronghold. He's created too much of a fortress. This kind you got to dig out. And it comes by fasting and prayer. Fasting and prayer says, I have no human option available. Fasting and prayer says that when you control what you eat, you move in the strength of that decision. Listen to me. When you say no to food and your stomach is hungry, now let me tell you, some of you probably did this, so let me clarify this right now. You did not fast during our solemn assembly if you ate enough at lunch so that you didn't feel hungry at dinner. That is not a fast. If you don't feel it, you didn't fast it. You didn't fast from television if you put it in the VCR so you could look at it after the fast was over. I better stop meddling. I know I'm meddling now. Because you really didn't sacrifice it. Fasting has to do with going through the pain of the body. Because you're trying to crack the shell so that there can be the freedom of the spirit. It is going through the agony. Of course your stomach is hurting when you're fasting. Of course your stomach is upset. But fasting says that I am going to wrestle through and deny you. Now, in order to deny your body dinner or whatever fast you happen to be on, all meals all day, whatever it happened to be, what you had to do was weaken the flesh. See, the flesh gets weaker because the flesh is hungry. So it is now weaker. But when the flesh becomes weak, It gives the opportunity when feeding the soul for the spirit to become stronger. You see, we don't express our spirits because we're so into satisfying our flesh that the free spirit is not free to become a mustard plant. But once you begin denying and fasting the craving of the body, what you do is get in the position where you are telling the flesh what it can do and what it cannot do. Flesh, you are not eating dinner today. Flesh, you are not being satisfied with television today. Flesh, you're going to do what you are not free to. You're not going to do what you used to be free to do because I, right now, am telling you no. Now watch this. God is saying when you can say no to food, you are saying no to the flesh. Any other addiction you have is an addiction of the flesh. So once you get used to telling the flesh it can't have everything it wants to have, whenever it wants to have it, you just now have to shift that from food to drugs, food to sex, food to lying, food to cussing, food to anything else, because you're moving in the strength of your decision. You are wrestling for the control of your life. And the choice to go against that force that enslaves you. Because you can control the physical, you now have been freed up to control the spiritual. That's why fasting is important. That's why you fast till you get a breakthrough. Some of you are fasting for difficulties in your life, and you want to know, Pastor, how long do I fast? Till you get a breakthrough. Okay? You do a meal a week. Or a day a month, or 3 days a month. Depends on how bad off you are. If it's bad enough, you'll fast hard enough, okay? I'm going to share with the singles. We have a sermon we're going to do, fasting for your mate. There's a story in the Bible of a man looking for a mate. And he thinks he's found her. He says, I think that's the one. And he goes to a house, sits down at the table to talk to the girl's father. And the father brings out some food, and the man says, I cannot eat till this matter is resolved. He put away food till he found the right wife. We're going to have a lot of skinny folk running around here. All right. Now, you want to know where that passage is, don't you? I'm not going to tell. I'm not going to tell you. You got to keep coming back while I preach. Okay? You fast so you get a breakthrough. James 4 says, when we humble ourselves before God, which fasting is. We saw that. Fasting is humbling yourself. When you humble yourself before God, he gives greater grace. He gives greater strength, greater power. Fasting in prayer is like a person using a sledgehammer against a concrete wall. You take the sledgehammer and you go, wham, it doesn't move. Wham, wham, wham. But after hitting it long enough, you're going to see a hairline splinter. There's a little hairline running through it. Once you see the hairline, you got it. See? First time you try this, it's going to be maybe a miserable experience. Maybe tough for you this week. That's because you haven't hit it in years. But you come against that thing and you hit that thing every Wednesday night. I'm going to fast. Or every third Friday morning, instead of eating breakfast, I'm going to spend that time in fasting and prayer. And I'm going to hit the sledgehammer against the mountain of my life. Nothing may happen the first week. Nothing may happen the second week. But after a while, you're going to see the hairline crack. And when you see the hairline crack, that means it's going to become a spider web a little later of cracks all over it. And all of a sudden, you're going to find it chipping. And when you discover it chipping because you keep coming against it, you're going to find the wall begins to shake down and break down until you can cross the partition to the other side. You keep at it because the demons are going to resist. This also tells us one thing about the disciples. They said, why couldn't we solve this problem for this man? Jesus said, because some things come by fasting and prayer. Now that tells us what the problem was with the preachers. They were living off of last week's power. They were depending on what happened in Matthew 10 when he gave them power over demons to cover Matthew 17. And last week's power is only good last week. Your closeness to God is good for the time you're close to him. Don't lean on last week's fasting for this week's power. If you need God this week, go to him in sacrifice and humility this week. They were living off a borrowed past. They were living off of what happened yesterday. They had neglected fasting and prayer. That's why you have to tell them this only comes through fasting and prayer. We are all bound by gravity, aren't we? Gravity simply says what goes up must come down, right? If we had everybody in here stand and jump, we would all go up, but quickly come back down. Some would go up higher than others, but nobody would last very long, because in this world, gravity rules. Gravity rules on planet Earth. In the atmosphere, the gravitational pull says, stay down. But some things overcome gravity. The law of aerodynamics, the thrust of the engines and the power and the speed resists gravity and doesn't come down. It goes up because a greater power has been introduced. Or magnets. You hold a magnet over a piece of metal and the metal jumps up. How come it defied gravity? Because the pull of the magnet, the law of magnetism, is greater than the law of gravity. That's why. Your mountain may be holding you down. It may be holding you down. Every time you try to jump out of your mess, the flesh sucks you right back in it. You don't want to be sucked in it, but it just keeps doing it. You know what you need? A greater power. I like to watch the Olympics, and I like to watch the high jumpers. 7-foot bar. They get way back, stare down, take off, turn sideways, lift themselves up. Beautiful. Strong, muscular legs that take them 7 feet high. And that's fine if you got a 7-foot mountain. But what happens when you have an 18-foot mountain? You need a different approach. See, if you're just a high jumper and you got an 18-foot mountain and you get back as far as you can get, go to church every Sunday, have devotions every day, I'm going to get way back here, get all the counseling I can get, and you just take off and you just make your way and you leap, we're going to all watch you make a fool of yourself, because you won't get across that bar. Ah, but in the Olympics, when those high jumpers see an 18-foot mountain, they get a pole. They're called pole vaulters. They get that pole and run down with that pole. Stick that pole in a hole in the ground and count on the pole to lift them higher so they can cross the bar that has been 18 feet high. If you got a mountain that ordinary Christianity won't get you over, why are you still trying to jump in your own flesh? What you need is a pole. You need something you can dig in and lean on and push on that will propel you over the mountain of your life so that you clear it and stop knocking it over. What you need is fasting and prayer. That is the pole vault to boost you over the mountain bars of your life. That is what God is calling you to. That is what he is asking you to do. That is the call of fasting and prayer.